Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and activist Jeremy Brecker, who urges peace groups to focus on supporting the UN weapons inspections as the White House works to undermine the process. David Longille with the Center for Social Justice in Toronto, who is helping coordinate an international team of volunteer citizen inspectors to conduct an examination of the U.S. military's weapons of mass destruction, and Antonia Juhas, Program Director with the International Forum on Globalization, who assesses Latin America's popular revolt against neoliberal free trade policies backed by Washington. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On December 3, 1984, as the people who lived in the slum neighborhood of Bhopal, India, were asleep, they were hit by one of the world's worst industrial chemical disasters in history. A deadly leak spread from the pesticide plant run by the former multinational corporation Union Carbide. The factory spewed 27 tons of a toxic gas that was created when water was accidentally diverted into a tank of MIC, or methyl isocyanate. Within days, over 4,000 people died, and hundreds of thousands of residents were blinded, disabled, or injured, some permanently. According to the New Internationalist magazine, public health in Bhopal remains in a crisis situation. Some women now reach menopause at the early age of 30, and many children have been born with deformities. 18 years after the accident, a recent report released by Greenpeace International found mercury levels at the factory site were between 20,000 and 6 million times higher than the normal level. In an attempt to right the worst possible public relations disaster, Union Carbide made an agreement with the Indian government to pay $470 million in damages. So far, only one-third of the money has gone to the victims, and a mere $8,300 has been spent on new drinking water wells. Most have been permanently contaminated by the toxins. In America, former Union Carbide president Warren Anderson lives comfortably in New York. India, seeking to bring more corporate business its way, has not pressed for Anderson to face criminal charges, including culpable homicide, which mandates a potential 20-year jail sentence. Over the last few weeks, the Service Employees International Union's Justice for Janitors campaign launched a major organizing drive in Boston. More than 10,000 union janitors who cleaned the big corporate office towers went on strike and won major increases in wages and benefits. With the help of religious leaders, the janitors, mostly undocumented immigrants, received the support of big financial firms like Fleet Boston and John Hancock in the push for a living wage. Yet there were mixed messages in Massachusetts this fall for immigrants. The Federal Immigration and Naturalization Service conducted major raids in East Boston and Cape Cod, rounding up dozens of undocumented Brazilians for deportation. According to The Nation magazine, the union drive and the INS raids reveal a stark contrast in American attitudes toward immigrants. On one hand, most politicians want to get tough on closing the border to newcomers in the post-9/11 environment. Yet businesses often seek out immigrants to do many of the nation's lowest-paying jobs. Immigration advocates worry about the prospect of a new guest worker or bracero program that might be proposed by President Bush and industry groups. The administration could create a temporary guest worker program that gives minimum wage workers few legal protections. As the world draws closer to war, Between the Lines mourns the death of 79-year-old Philip Berrigan, lifelong pacifist, former Catholic priest, and campaigner for nuclear abolition. On Friday evening, December 6th, Berrigan died of liver and kidney cancer at Jonah House, a pacifist community near Baltimore that Berrigan and his wife Elizabeth McAllister, a former nun, founded. Berrigan first committed civil disobedience in 1967 with his brother, Reverend Daniel Berrigan. A year later, as part of the Catonsville Nine, they orchestrated one of the most dramatic protests against the Vietnam War, dousing hundreds of draft cards with homemade napalm and igniting them in a parking lot in Catonsville, Maryland. By 1980, Philip Berrigan led the plowshares movement by pouring blood and hammering the warheads at a General Electric missile plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Berrigan was arrested over 100 times in his lifetime and served 11 years in jail for his acts of conscience against American militarism. He was last arrested in December 1999 for banging on an A-10 Warthog warplane. Berrigan was sentenced to 30 months in prison and was released last December from federal prison in Elkton, Ohio. Howard Zinn, historian and a personal friend of Berrigan, called him one of the great Americans of our time. Born in Minnesota, Philip Francis Berrigan grew up in Syracuse, New York, and was the youngest of six brothers. He joined the Army Infantry in World War II. After the war, he went to Holy Cross College, entered the priesthood in 1955, and spent the late 1950s teaching in an all-black Catholic high school in New Orleans. Shortly before his death, Berrigan restated his often-heard declaration that nuclear weapons are the scourge of the earth. To manufacture, deploy, and use them is a curse against God, the human family, and the earth itself. Philip Berrigan was buried in a simple pine coffin. He survived by his wife, three children, and three brothers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Even before the December 8th deadline by which Iraq was directed to present a complete inventory of its weapons programs, the Bush administration was working hard to cast doubt on the viability of the United Nations inspections program to avert conflict. Now that Baghdad has turned over some 12,000 pages of documents they claim detail their compliance with the post-Gulf War ban on their nation's possession of weapons of mass destruction, the White House is searching hard for evidence of a material breach to justify war. The endgame within the UN Security Council is playing out as the Pentagon calls up tens of thousands of military reservists, engages in war games, and prepositions troops and equipment throughout the Persian Gulf region. On December 10th, International Human Rights Day, over 150 anti-war events were organized by peace groups in cities across the U.S. While the growing movement of people across the world who oppose a preemptive attack on Iraq hope that the inspections process can prevent war, it's very clear that the Bush administration's stated goal of regime change in Iraq will not easily be deterred. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author, activist, and historian Jeremy Brecker, whose recent article, A Nightmare to Love, How the Peace Movement Can Use Bush's Almost Desperate Attempts to Destroy the Arms Inspection, urges those opposed to war to condemn the White House campaign to construct a pretext justifying an invasion of Iraq.
The problem from the point of view of the administration is that the inspection process, much to their surprise, I think, has been embraced by Iraq, at least so far. Saddam Hussein actually went so far as making a speech to the people of Iraq saying, we want to please cooperate with the inspectors because they are protecting us against the Americans. This is not at all what the United States had in mind, but it is probably what a good deal of the rest of the Security Council had in mind when it set up the inspection program. This makes a terrible problem for the administration because the great majority of the American people would like nothing better than for the inspection process to work. And in order to prevent that, the administration has been taking one step after another to try to prevent it from working. But what this means is that the peace movement, in criticizing and bringing out all the things that the administration is doing to try to undermine the inspection process, really is in a tremendously strong position to appeal to the American people and to separate them from the administration, to make it clear to them that the administration is gung-ho to fight a war against Iraq, even when there is an excellent alternative for dealing with the alleged security problems presented by Iraq in terms of weapons of mass destruction.
Jeremy, I just wanted to quote to you something from the paper. On Monday, December 9th, the New York Times on its front page had this to say, in private, administration officials concede that there is no single piece of dramatic intelligence that Iraq has continued to try to acquire nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. Certainly, if that's true, it's going to make it quite difficult for the Bush administration to convince the American people or the world that a war is necessary and imminent.
I think that's exactly right. They are a bit stymied and I think a bit at a loss about how to respond to this. Now, it's always possible that the hawks in the Bush administration will just say, look, our chance to fight a war is slipping away. I remember one of the leading hawks a few months ago saying, you know, time is not on our side about this. If we don't attack soon, we're going to lose our opportunity. It's always conceivable that they will decide to go that route. But first of all, they have serious military problems in doing it because they don't really have enough in the way of bases to do it from. So for them to drop 75,000 American boys and girls down in the middle of the desert from ships, you know, using planes and helicopters, this is not a scenario that the American military is going to like very much. But equally important from a political point of view, what seems like is going to happen is if the Americans say they're lying and we have the evidence, then the whole world's going to say, where's the evidence? And as the inspectors have said, well, tell us where the secret weapons programs that you're talking about are, and we'll go inspect them because we're the people who have the international legitimacy and the right to go and look for them. And if the Americans don't actually provide that information and say, well, they're here and they're there and those are the places you should go inspect, I think they're going to have very tough sledding in the United Nations with attempting to stampede it into some kind of endorsement of a U.S. attack.
Jeremy, do you think the peace movement is on the right track? And by that, I mean, do you think, in terms of the strategic opportunities that are opened up right now under the United Nations weapons inspections regime, that the peace movement here is taking full advantage of that?
I don't think that we have been up to this point. I think that people, very understandably, were extremely skeptical of the inspection process because the United States seemingly had supported it, although in fact it was more or less coerced into accepting it. But it certainly was originated out of hostility to Iraq. The United Nations process has been manipulated extensively by the United States in the past, and I think that large parts of the peace movement assumed that we had the same story. But in fact, the rest of the world is very, very upset about American unilateralism and is very interested in containing it, and that means, above all else, containing the U.S. attempt to destroy Iraq. And that creates a somewhat new situation, and that's the one that we ought to be responding to and taking advantage of.
That was activist and historian Jeremy Brecker, whose article, A Nightmare to Love, How the Peace Movement Can Use Bush's Almost Desperate Attempts to Destroy the Arms Inspection, can be read online at www.commondreams.org. Later this winter, thousands of volunteer citizen inspectors will enter the U.S. from Canada in an effort to examine the U.S. military's arsenal of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. Citing guidelines put forth by the Bush administration itself, the coalition of groups, which includes Greenpeace Canada, the Toronto Committee Against War and Sanctions on Iraq, and Global Exchange, hope to expose the double standards and hypocrisy that they say is manifest in White House policies toward Iraq and international law. The Rooting Out Evil Coalition, as they call themselves, declared that the current U.S. administration poses a great threat to global security and demanded that the Bush administration grant their inspectors immediate and unfettered access to any site in the country, including all presidential compounds. The group will field their inspection team on February 22nd and 23rd, 2003. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Longille, Director of Public Affairs with the Center for Social Justice in Toronto, Canada, and a coordinator of the Rooting Out Evil Coalition, who explains the goals of the inspection campaign and assesses Canadian public opinion toward the U.S. drive for war with Iraq.
Well, this was quite a spontaneous project. Just a bunch of old peace activists got together and thought, what could we do? That would take advantage of our situation here in Canada, where we're close to the border, have the longest undefended border in the world. We thought we'll recruit as many volunteer weapons inspectors as we can and invite prominent people from Canada, the United States, and Europe to join us and send our team of inspectors into the U.S. to search for chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons.
Now, tell us a little bit about the coalition that is part of this grouping under the banner of Rooting Out Evil.
Well, we've got the Center for Social Justice, and we normally work on issues of inequality, the growing gap between rich and poor, and problems that affect our democracy. But in this case, we feel we have to get involved in this issue because it's pretty hard to address questions of inequality if all our funds are going towards the military, and that's what we're afraid of. We're in this with Greenpeace, Greenpeace Canada. From the United States, some of the major groups, the National Network to End the War Against Iraq, Global Exchange in California, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, headquartered in Washington. So we've got a wide variety of groups in both Canada and the United States.
And might I ask a leading question here about how you happened to select the United States as a nation to inspect? From what I read, you based it on some criteria outlined by the Bush administration.
That's right. According to President Bush's own criteria, the most dangerous states are those run by leaders who have massive stockpiles of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, ignore due process at the United Nations, and refuse to sign and honor international treaties, and finally, those who have come to power through illegitimate means. And we think the current U.S. administration fulfills all these criteria. You've certainly got the weapons, ignoring due process of the United Nations, refusing to sign and honor international treaties, including treaties that would ban biological weapons. And I think there's a lot of Americans that think that perhaps that election a few years ago wasn't altogether kosher and legitimate.
Logistically, how will this work? When is it about to happen? And, give us some of the other details that you can share.
The action itself we're hoping to do on the weekend of February 22nd and 23rd, recruiting this prominent team of international weapons inspectors. That would include parliamentarians from Europe and from Canada, perhaps from the U.S. We're still putting together that team. Would leave Toronto and head down to the border. There may be other actions across the country. We have over 5,000 inspectors have already volunteered, So this is amazing success. We'll see if we can get into the United States. I suspect that some of the volunteer weapons inspectors either may not get in or may choose to stay in Canada. But that evening, we hope to have a major rally on the American side, calling witnesses. A lot of the American groups have volunteered that they have local sites that contain weapons of mass destruction and are suggesting that we come and check out their community. That's what we'll do on the Sunday, is we'll travel to the closest weapons facility in the Northeast.
So obviously this is symbolic, tongue-in-cheek series of actions, but what message do you hope to send to the United States, Canada, and the world from this?
We'd like to call the president on his hypocrisy. We want to, at all costs. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, if we could do anything at all to avoid a war, we'd like to do that. We think that people should be addressing basic needs. The best protection against terrorism is peace-building rather than war-making, and that means taking care of people's need for food, clothing, and shelter. So rather than the government's wasting billions of trillions of dollars on weapons, everyone in the world, we think, could obtain an education and health care and clean drinking water with that kind of money.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about Canadian public opinion. Now, we don't hear a lot about it here in the United States. Sometimes we hear about some polling data from Europe. But our neighbor to the north, what do they think about the Bush agenda for war with Iraq?
Well, Canadian public opinion is fairly evenly balanced. Right now, the majority, 41%, saying they cannot support Canada participating in a military campaign against Iraq. 40% are in support, so pretty evenly balanced. But here's what's interesting. There's been quite a shift in the last year. 52% of Canadians think that our relations with the U.S. have deteriorated. And that's very interesting because right after September 11th, there was quite an outpouring of sympathy and support. But it's been blown away. 65% now believe that the U.S. had no business telling Canadians to increase our defense spending or pushing our country to support Washington's hawkish foreign policy. So I guess I'm noticing that all this war is driving Canadians away. I think it's turning off people around the world. You want to know, when Canadians are asked whether Bush or Saddam Hussein pose a bigger threat to world peace, 56% of respondents say it's the Iraqi leader. But 38% say it was Bush. Now, that doesn't mean that we think he's evil, Bush, but rather that as leader of the world's hyperpower, the American leader has more firepower at his disposal, and any misstep or miscalculation he makes would have catastrophic results, more so than Saddam Hussein, however nutty or evil he might be.
That was David Longeil with the Rooting Out Evil Coalition and the Center for Social Justice in Toronto, Canada. Find out how you can become an honorary inspector and participate in this action by visiting the group's website at www.rootingoutevil.org. second round of Ecuador's presidential election conducted November 24th, Edwin Gutierrez was named the winner with 54% of the vote. The former army colonel, who took power for several hours in a coup more than 2 years ago, campaigned on a platform of attacking corruption in high places and promoting economic policies that will benefit his nation's poor majority. Gutierrez's victory is the latest in a sweep for progressive parties in recent elections throughout Latin America, where a severe economic decline has dramatically changed the political landscape. In October, the Workers' Party's Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva was the first leftist candidate to win Brazil's presidency. Backed by diverse grassroots movements, political parties that are resisting Washington's economic policies of free trade, privatization, and concessions to multinational corporations have also made significant gains in legislative votes in Peru, Bolivia, and Costa Rica. Argentina, whose economy many believe was destroyed by adherence to policies set by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, may also see a turn to the left in presidential elections next year. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Antonia Yuhas, program director with the International Forum on Globalization, who assesses Latin America's popular revolt against the so-called Washington Consensus and worldwide resistance to corporate-led economic globalization.
There's been just a sea change, a wave of popular resistance being reflected in elections across Central and South America. We have Ecuador, Brazil, I would add to the list of Argentina, very clearly suffering from and responding negatively to the policies of the Washington Consensus, the corporate globalization model. Also, you have Venezuela, Uruguay, just all across the continent. And it's really not surprising, and I think using Argentina and Brazil as examples is instructive. Argentina in particular, which even 2 years ago was really being heralded by the International Monetary Fund as a poster child for a country that is following the rules exactly, doing exactly what we want them to do, and therefore should be a banner of success. And very quickly, most would say, because of following the rules of the International Monetary Fund, Argentina has collapsed in just a horrible economic crisis that hurts the most and most directly impacts the already poor and now growing poor segment of the economy. And the same has been true across the region with countries that have had forced liberalization policies pushed on them by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And, of course, this is at the behest of the United States, just how that works in case listeners aren't clear. The United States is the largest giver of money, U.S. taxpayer money, to the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. And because these institutions are not fully democratic, they're run by whoever gives the most money gets the most say. And so we have a very large disproportionate voice in what happens with the money that of those institutions. The U.S. has led forced liberalization policies across the region. And in addition, hand-wringing by the U.S., forcing economies to open up to specific industries in particular. In Venezuela, a very good example is the U.S. oil industry gaining access to Venezuela under the pressure of the U.S. government. All of these policies have been tried for the past two decades, and the result has been fairly universal. A small collection of elites have done quite well and thus have continued to push the policies, whereas the vast majority of people in the country and a growing number of people in the country are suffering the consequences of poverty, unemployment, lack of access to vital human resources like water and healthcare and education. And the people have responded. And very interestingly, I would say, the people have responded even in the face of U.S. at least supported opposition to the functioning democracies. So Venezuela is a very good example of, most people would agree, at least a U.S. supported and potentially even worse coup against the democratically elected leader of Venezuela. And many now fear another coup may be in the works.
Is it not true that the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the United States, World Trade Organization have a lot of capability to punish nations who resist their policies? And I mean by that they can cripple a country economically by denying them loans and otherwise locking them out of the global economy thereby discrediting, if not destroying, these politicians who have campaigned against these policies.
There is potential great harm that these institutions can do to countries that default on their loans. The biggest harm that they can do is not give their seal of approval, so not give additional loans themselves and make it so that private investors flee countries and private banks don't give additional investments. But the fact is, you know, countries like Argentina, Brazil, others, they're facing this situation already largely because of, as I said, following the policies of the IMF and the World Bank. The policies of the IMF and the World Bank have already wreaked havoc on their economies. So I think what you're going to see is a big turning inside. We already see the countries of Central and South America turning inside and deciding that they're most likely going to reject a free trade area of the Americas being pushed by the Bush administration for a trade pact that's Canada, the United States, Central and South America, and the Caribbean, except for Cuba, and instead negotiate a trade pact just between the Central and South American countries, one that works internally for them.
Let me just ask you in closing here to talk about momentum, because I think all around the world, momentum continues to build for this movement challenging corporate-led globalization, with hundreds of thousands of people gathering in almost every continent against these policies. But here in the United States, I think the effects of the September 11th attack certainly took their toll. But how do you foresee the movement here in the U.S. regaining momentum, if you see that at all?
The protest movement is alive and well in the United States. Where the energy is being focused is the question. And I think we don't need to judge this movement by the size of the crowds that gather on the street. We judge it by the impact that it's having on changing policy and changing the way people think. And, you know, Central and South America is a great example of how policies are changing, and the policies and the decisions that people make have certainly taken hold as being against the model of corporate-led globalization, and that's, you know, the best victory we can ask for.
That was Antonio Yuhas, Program Director with the International Forum on Globalization. Contact the forum by calling area code 415-561-3480 or visit their website at www.ifg.org. Listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website, www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.